nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology. You can follow along with this presentation by going to nanohub.org and downloading the corresponding slides. Enjoy the show.
One more lecture on balance equations. Like I said, this is one of the key things that you should take away from this course. So we have a final lecture today, and then we dive into something new on Wednesday. So, you know, just by way of reminder again, the idea is not to solve the Boltzmann equation, but to take moments of the Boltzmann equation and solve for the quantities that we really want and see if we can do that. So we have this prescription. The quantity that we want we call n sub phi, and we get it by weighting the distribution by some function of momentum. And then this is an equation we can just write down by, you know, it. Any physical quantity has to be conserved. You could just write this thing down in advance. But we'll go through the math and we get the prescriptions. You know, the rate of change of the quantity is minus divergence of the flux of the quantity. So we just take the quantity times velocity to get a flux. The quantity might be generated, but we're talking about quantities that are functions of momentum. We're not talking about explicitly generating electrons. The electric field generates momentum, right? So the generation rate involves the electric field. And recombination, again, it's how much of the quantity we lose. At what rate do we lose it? Electrons aren't disappearing because we haven't put recombination centers in. But scattering might destroy momentum and therefore relax the quantity. So we had the zeroth moment, and the zeroth moment gives us the electron continuity equation. Current is constant in steady state because we have no explicit generation recombination. We have the first moment, and usually the way you take the first moment is you make your function some component of p along one of the axes. So the quantity is the total momentum density in some direction, so that's capital P sub z. And the flux is the flux of momentum, so it's a flux of a flux because momentum is a flux. If I want to take the flux in any direction, I'll just take the velocity in the ith direction. And if I'm interested in the momentum in the z direction, then I end up with this quantity W sub zi, which is a component of a tensor. So it's minus divergence of the associated flux, so I get this. The recombination rate is just momentum density over momentum relaxation time, and the electric field generates momentum. So if we put that in, there are different ways that we could write this. The first line is the direct way we just saw. More generally, I could ask for the momentum density in any direction, x, y, or z. So then I've got this nine-component tensor. And if I want to write that in symbolic notation instead of indicial notation, it would look like this. So here I have minus divergence of a tensor. So that gives me a vector. Okay, so we should talk just a little bit about this tensor W, which is related to energy. So it's a 3x3 tensor in 3D. And its definition, it just comes out of applying that formula. You just apply that formula and this is what you get. Right. So it's momentum times velocity. So that's like mv squared. So it's related to energy, you know. But if it's momentum in one direction and velocity in another direction, that's not energy, right? But it's a tensor that has the units of energy. And if I look at the actual energy density, that would be what I would call W, right? No tensor. And if parabolic bands, and we're only going to talk about parabolic bands today, the energy density would be 1/2 mv squared. Actually, I have to put an n here because 1/2 m times average velocity squared per electron. This would be the energy per electron. I'd have to multiply by the electron density to get the total energy density per unit volume. And v squared has a vx squared, a vy squared, and a vz squared. Okay. So if I wanted to make a simplifying assumption, which we frequently need to do, We could say, well, we know in equilibrium the average value of the velocity along any direction is equal to the other two. So I could say each one of these is one third of the total. Right? That's how we get total energy is 3/2 kT. It's 1/2 kT along the x direction, 1/2 along the y, 1/2 along the z. Now, that's not obvious that that's true when you apply an electric field, because you're trying to accelerate electrons in one direction. Right? Scattering will try to wash it out and work against that. But this is an approximation that at least we can make, and it's frequently made, and it should be reasonably close. So in that way, I can relate this 3x3 tensor to this energy density, and it's a diagonal tensor with a Kronecker delta. So then you'll see we frequently simplify. You know, if we take our momentum balance equation, convert it into a current equation, this is what we get. If we assume that things don't change too quickly on the scale of a momentum relaxation time, then we throw away the derivative. If we additionally make some simplifying assumption for this 3x3 tensor that it's diagonal, then we get an expression like that. And you'll see that from time to time. So it's drift and diffusion, but it's not diffusion just due to concentration gradients. Whenever there's an energy gradient, you get diffusion currents. Okay, so that's our simplified drift diffusion equation. And if we just go ahead and say, well, this energy density is electron density times 3/2 K electron temperature, might be higher than the lattice temperature if we have a big electric field, might even be lower if we're going over a barrier and the electric field is slowing us down, then we're going to talk in today's lecture more about how we can be more careful about what we mean by temperature, but this seems plausible, right? And if I assume the temperature is constant, then when I do that gradient, I won't have any gradients of temperature, so I won't get any thermoelectric effects. But you'll get your old familiar drift diffusion equation, and you'll get an Einstein relation that instead of having the lattice temperature, will have the electron temperature. So if you have a high electric field, the electron temperature can easily, in silicon, be 3,000 K instead of 300 K, even though your lattice is at 300 K. So the diffusion coefficient can be much bigger than you what might have expected. So we'll talk about that in a few lectures. Okay, so that's the first moment. We did the zeroth moment. We did the first moment. The second moment is the energy density. So the quantity we're interested in is the energy density. Instead of making that simplified assumption that we did in the previous slide, we could solve for it if we want to be more careful. Then the flux is a flux of energy. That's what we call our energy flux. The input power from the electric field is J dot E. That's inputting energy to the electrons. But inelastic scattering is taking the energy away. So we get this energy balance equation. Okay, and of course, now we've got something else that we don't know. So to recap, we have these different moments. If we actually go ahead and do another balance equation for that energy flux in the energy balance equation, then we get yet another balance equation, and it involves yet another quantity that we have to write another balance equation for. So then we get to recapping the literature. Okay, so that's a review of where we've been so far. Now, if you want something to think about, this is the assignment for today, if you've seen the homework assignment. So, you know, you'll see these things written all different kinds of ways in various papers. And if you just follow these prescriptions that we've been using in the book, Chapter 5, and in these lectures, you should be able to figure out what the people that are writing these equations in papers, what they're doing, what assumptions they're making, and where they came from. So, for example, you will sometimes see people write the drift diffusion equation this way, and you will sometimes see them write it this way. You know, and the question is, which one of those is correct? Maybe they're both correct, but maybe under different conditions. So you should be able to sort that out just by looking at the current equation that we derived earlier and figuring out which one of those two is correct. And you should do that first before you read this paper. I guess this is a new, he was using new for carrier density. So this is an old paper. The title of the paper was D grad carrier density or grad D times carrier density. You know? So you can see what he thinks about that. So this is one of these things, you know, just as a comment. You guys are all, you're all PhD students, right? So you're writing papers. So one of the things you do in writing a paper is you do two things. One is you want people to read your paper. And there's so much written these days that just writing a paper that people will think, oh, this looks interesting. I should spend the time to read it. Right? That's a challenge. But the other thing you want to think about is, like this paper. I read this paper 25 years ago. I've never forgotten it. Right? I mean, that's the other thing you want to think about is, how do I write a paper that people won't forget? You know, 25 years from now, they'll think, ah, I read that paper by so-and-so, and I've never forgotten it. Now, that's pretty hard to do. But if you try to do it, you know, you may get one or two, right? If you don't think about it, you may not get one, right? Okay, so that's review. There are two topics. You know, this one, just I think you should know something about transport in materials where the composition varies with position. So I'll just say a little bit about that. But I want to talk about temperature because we bring in these K electron temperatures all the time, and it's not quite obvious how we're doing this or how we can justify it. So we want to talk about electron temperature more carefully. I guess I should stop here before we really dive into today's lectures. Are there any questions on balance equations before we plunge on? Okay, so a lot of times high field transport is called hot carrier transport because the electrons have a temperature that's hotter than the lattice. And the idea is they gain energy from the electric field, and then they emit optical phonons and they lose energy. Okay. So if the electric field is very high, they can gain energy faster than they can lose it. And the kinetic energy density W increases, or T increases, so they become hot. These problems occur many times, so we want to understand how we think about electron temperature and hot carriers. So the idea, you know, in thermal equilibrium, these electrons are bouncing around, they're scattering. It looks like random thermal motion. The kinetic energy is 3/2 K, where T is the lattice temperature, which is also the electron temperature. But if you apply an electric field, you're going to tend to increase the velocity in one direction. Okay, but then the scattering will randomize it. So the velocity will actually be increased in all the directions, whether you like it or not. Okay. Maybe it'll be increased a little more in the direction of the electric field than the other two. Depends on the strength of the scattering. So we'll make some definitions. You know, we know how to compute the kinetic energy density. It's just a moment of F. Right? And we're going to assume parabolic bands. So energy is 1/2 mv squared. So I can write the kinetic energy density. You know, this is like I'm taking an average of 1/2 mv squared. Okay, but I need to divide by sum over f in order to normalize it. But that sum over f is n. So the kinetic energy density is carrier density times 1/2 m average velocity squared. Okay. Okay. Now we're going to look at that average. Actually, I shouldn't have the brackets here now. I can write the velocity, remove those brackets. I can write the velocity as the average velocity plus the deviation from the average. Okay. So every electron, you know, I can just say it's going at some velocity, which I'm just going to write as the average velocity of all of them plus that particular electron's deviation from the average. This people call the peculiar velocity because it's peculiar to every electron, different for every electron. But now you can see that if I do take the average value of that has to be zero because my overall average velocity is the average drift velocity of all of the electrons. So the average value of that peculiar velocity is zero. Okay, now to do this kinetic energy density, I need to take the average value of V squared. Okay, so I could just, remember, remove these brackets here. I could just take V dot V to get V squared. So I could dot average drift velocity plus peculiar velocity into itself. And I would get average VD squared. I would get average peculiar velocity squared. And then I would get a cross product, 2C dot V, average velocity. Right. Okay. Now I have to take the average value of that. So when I take the average value of this, it doesn't depend on momentum. It's already an average. Right. So I get 1/2 mv drift squared. And when I take the average value of this, you know, this is just a constant. I can pull it out of the sum. Then I'm going to take the average value of the peculiar velocity. By definition, that's zero. So nothing comes from this. The last term, I have to take the average value of the peculiar velocity squared. That'll be finite, right? Because, you know, some electrons have a positive deviation from the average, some have a negative, but when I do C squared, I'll get a finite value. So I can, you know, we've just done a little, made a definition, and we've now written the kinetic energy density in a different way. There's a part due to the average motion of all of the electrons, and then there's a part due to the random motion of the electrons. So you can kind of guess that temperature should be associated with the random part of it, right? Not with the average part of it, right? Okay, so this is what we have, and now we'll just make a definition. It seems plausible, right? This is 1/2 m times the average value of the random part of the velocity squared, right? Right? Thermal energy is a random motion. So this is the way, this would be the way that you would define electron temperature, and it looks like a very physical, reasonable thing to do. Okay, so that's going to be our definition of temperature. So let's see how that would work. Near equilibrium, if I have a very low electric field, then I know what the distribution function is. It's an equilibrium Maxwellian, say, if I'm non-degenerate. And the spread of that Maxwellian is related to the temperature. And the electron temperature and the lattice temperature are the same. Right. Now, when we solve the Boltzmann equation under small electric fields, we saw that the result was a displaced Maxwellian. You put an electric field in, it puts a force on all of the electrons and moves the distribution of states that are occupied in a direction opposite the electric field. Now, if it's a small electric field, it doesn't input much energy to the electrons. So the temperature is still where it was, but the distribution is displaced. So now we're displaced by some, you know, and we could figure out what that is, right? dK dt is equal to minus qE. It operates for a time tau, and then scattering destroys it. So it's just qE tau is a displacement in k-space. Okay. But the temperature hasn't changed. Okay. Now, if I apply a really big electric field, then I input a lot of energy to the electrons. And my plot isn't really very good here. The displacement will increase. Okay. But those electrons will scatter more because they have more energy. We've seen scattering rates always increase with energy. And that will randomize the velocity. So this distribution won't just be moved out to much higher average values. It'll also spread. Okay. Now the temperature, now two things have happened. We've displaced the Maxwellian more than in the first case, the second case. But we've also increased the spread because the electron temperature is bigger than the lattice temperature. So, you know, that's the way I would think about qualitatively about how that distribution changes when I start going to higher electric fields. So if we go back to a familiar example, say the velocity field curve of silicon, we're going to talk in a few lectures about how you calculate this curve and a little, put some numbers in and do a little more in detail. But you'll remember, you know, down at low electric fields, the velocity is mu times the electric field. So just proportional to the electric field. At about 10 kilovolts per centimeter, the velocity saturates. And it saturates in silicon at a velocity of 10 to the 7th. So if I go up here to 10 to the 5th or so, it's a very high electric field. We're importing lots of energy to the electrons. So the energy density is going to... Oops, I should get rid of that N there. It has these two components. It has this component we call drift energy. This represents the peak of that Maxwellian that's been displaced. Vd squared is 10 to the 7th centimeters per second squared. And then it also has a component due to the spread. And the question is, you know, how does it divide up? Is most of the kinetic energy in the average motion of the carriers, or is it most of it in the random motion of the carriers? Turns out that most of it is in the random motion. You know, when you plot these things, you'll see a displacement, but it's relatively small. You'll see a big spread of the distribution. As I mentioned earlier, this thing can, at 10 to the 5th volts per centimeter, this can easily be 3,000 Kelvin for silicon, right? It's spread a lot. There's a lot of kinetic energy there. Put numbers in, and this is a relatively small 10% or less. Okay. Now, there are cases in small devices in which that first term can become very important and interesting effects occur, things like velocity overshoot. Right? We'll talk about them. But in a bulk semiconductor, if you apply a big electric field, let everything settle down, you'll usually find that their carriers are very energetic, but most of the energy is in random motion, not in the average motion. Right. Yes?
So when you apply that high electric field and you say that this electron temperature is different from the last, mm-hmm. we're assuming that electron-electron scattering is more than electron-photon scattering, right?
Yeah, so that's a good point. You know, to talk about temperature, the easiest way to talk about temperature is to say I have a Maxwellian distribution, right? And then the temperature is the thing that fits in that Maxwellian and gives me the spread. In order to get that, you have to have a lot of electron-electron scattering so that the electron ensemble...
Yeah, so they're in equilibrium with each other.
Yeah.
So if I increase my last temperature, though, would I have to apply a larger electric field to get to that point where the electrons are in equilibrium with each other but not with the lattice? In other words...
Well, what you need is a high enough electron density, right, such that... Given the electron-phonon scattering, the electron-electron scattering is more important, right?
When you have a high density.
Yeah. So if you apply a higher electric field, you'll get more electron-phonon scattering because it's proportional to the density of states. And they'll be more energetic. There will be more states for them to scatter to. So the electron-phonon scattering will get bigger. Now, if you're assuming that you have these nice plots, like I showed earlier, that they're Maxwellian, it means that the electron-electron scattering is even bigger than that.
Right.
So it takes a high electron density.
Okay, but so if I had the same electric field, and I'm in this region where the electrons are out of equilibrium with the lattice, but equilibrium with each other, and I increase a lattice temperature, then I would go back into that regime where they're both in equilibrium because I'm increasing the amount of electron-phonon scattering.
Yeah, but now you're exchanging energy with equilibrium phonons. So that would be, you would be closer to equilibrium now if you've increased the lattice temperature, right? At the same electric field, now you'll be closer to equilibrium because it's how much additional energy you've input with the electric field, right?
Okay.
Yeah. But this is, I mean, these are good questions and, you know, these are really tough problems. We will show you later on when you actually solve for what the distribution functions look like that they very often don't look anything like a Maxwellian. And a lot of times people get very, it's very qualitative. You just say 3/2 kT is equal to kinetic energy. And it's just the average of this distribution, which might not even look like a Maxwellian. Okay, that was a good question. Anything? So electron temperature, that's what electron temperature is. And it's sort of easy to explain what it is. It makes sense. It's hard in practice to justify that we really have a well-defined temperature with a Maxwellian distribution. But the next thing is heat flux. Like, so if we have temperature gradients, or even if we don't have temperature gradients, we have Peltier effects. You know, we have heat flowing. So let's see if we can get the heat flux. And, you know, the heat flux is something like an energy flux, but not quite, because a heat flux has to do with the, you know, the diffusion of carriers that are undergoing a random thermal motion. If they're all moving at the same velocity, there's no temperature, there's no heat flux. There's an energy flux, but there's no heat flux. So heat should also be associated with a random thermal motion. So this is the energy flux, but it's not the heat flux, right? Sometimes you'll see people being a little bit loose and they'll call it the heat flux, but it isn't. And very few people do that. Okay, so let's see if we can figure this out. Again, we will assume a Maxwellian distribution, so the energy is 1/2 mv squared. I'm only going to ask for the energy flux in the x direction, and we'll see if we can figure out the energy flux in the x direction and figure out what part of it is heat flux. Okay, so what we're doing here is computing the average value of the quantity magnitude of v squared times v in the x direction. That's what's giving us the x-directed energy flux. Okay, again, we're going to do the same thing. If I want vx, that's the average velocity in the x direction plus the deviation of the velocity from the average value. So this is the peculiar velocity again. And I'm going to, you know, we can easily get all kinds of tensor expressions. I'm just going to assume that there's an electric field in the x direction. There's an average velocity in the x direction. The average velocity in the y and the z directions is zero. Right? You know, you can look in the book to see what happens when you don't make that assumption. Just everything becomes a tensor. We kind of minimize the tensors this way. Okay, so we have magnitude of v squared, and then we write vx as its average value plus its deviation from the average. Okay, so when I take averages, you know, this is already an average, so I can pull it out. So the first term gives me an average value of v squared times the average velocity in the x direction. The second one gives me an average value of v squared times the peculiar velocity in the x direction. And it's not quite obvious what that is, so we have to work on that a little bit. Okay, so the first one, you know, this is going to be easy to handle. 1/2 m v squared, average v squared, this is kinetic energy density. So this is just going to give us a w times vdx. All right. This one requires a little more thought about what that one is. Okay. So again, the x-directed velocity is its average value plus its deviation from average. There is a total velocity, okay, and it's the average total velocity, which I'm assuming is only in the x direction, just to make life simple, plus the deviation from the average, but it can move in all three directions. So c has components in all three directions. Okay. So I want v squared, so I take v dot v, and I get v squared, average value of the velocity squared, it's only in the x direction, that's all I have, plus 2 drift velocity times c, plus c squared, all times that cx, right? I just have to be careful about doing this here. So then I have three terms to look at. I have an average drift velocity squared times cx. So the only thing I have to average is cx. All right, that is an average. Plus 2 drift velocity dot c. There's only a drift velocity in the x direction. I've just assumed that to make life easy. So I'm only going to get a cx, but then I had a cx here. So I get an average value of cx squared. And then the last one is an average value of c squared times cx. All right. Just requires, you know, no rocket science. Just requires being careful. All right. All right, so now let's see if we can figure out what we have here. The first term, as I mentioned, this is just energy density, so it's just W times the drift velocity. If I look at this term, I get zero, because when I average the peculiar velocity, by definition, it's zero. If I look at this term, the one-halves drop, boom, boom, I just get a CX squared times VDX. Boom, boom. I may have lost an M here, right? I think I lost an M there. And if I look at the last term, I've got the 1/2 MN times average velocity of C squared times CX. So that's not so obvious what it is. So this is the average value of the peculiar velocity in all three directions, right? CX squared plus CY squared plus CZ squared times CX. Okay, so if we put those together, now my M has come back, fortunately. This is what we got, you know, just by making our definitions. And let's see what we have here. Now, in equilibrium, we know the average value of 1/2 mv squared is 3/2 kt. The average value of 1/2 mvx squared is 3/2 is 1/2 kt, right? Equal partition. This seems reasonable to say that this is random thermal motion in the x direction. So 1/2 m random thermal motion in the x direction should be 1/2 kt. So that's how we define temperature. That's consistent with what we did before. You know, if I take the total magnitude of C, Cx squared plus Cy squared plus Cz squared, I'd get 3/2 kt. Okay. So this term here just gives me a kt. Okay. I'm just going to make a definition now. It's like that tensor x that we had when we did it earlier, and we did a moment equation for x. I have something that I really can't evaluate. I have to take an average of this over the distribution. I can't take this any further. I don't know what this is. This is a place I have to terminate the hierarchy now. I have to do something reasonable. It looks like this is a heat flux, because, you know, an energy flux is 1/2 m v squared times velocity. This is only dealing with the random parts of the velocity. It's 1/2 m random velocity squared times velocity in the x direction. So it looks like heat, right? And that's what people call it. You know, it looks like how you would, you know, like how you would define heat. You just simply replace the energy in the energy flux by the random part of the energy. That's what we're going to define as heat flux. I put it in quotes because you can see I'm not quite comfortable about this, about is this heat or not. Okay, so we write it out this way, and this is what we get. This is another way to write our energy flux when we're doing it in terms of temperature. It's kinetic energy density times Vd plus nkt times drift velocity plus heat flux. We've just decomposed it into three parts. We still don't know. We have a hierarchy equation. We don't know what the capital Qx is. We have to do something reasonable. Now, people will try to interpret this, you know, what does this mean? What do these three components mean? And the explanation that they give is, think about, you have a semiconductor, you have a gas of electrons, and you have some average velocity in the x direction. So if I take a little volume inside, this is going to move through at the average velocity. And if I ask, you know, what is the energy flux that's being carried? Well, part of it is just the kinetic energy density inside this little volume moving at a velocity Vd. So quantity times velocity, that's a flux. That's just, okay. That's associated with the average motion of that kinetic energy through the system. Now, Q, the way I would interpret it is that I'm either gaining or losing energy as this little volume is moving through, because heat is diffusing in or out, right? So that's the Q term. And then what's this middle term? What's its physical significance? And, you know, the argument that people use is we have this ideal gas law that says pressure times volume is NKT. Okay. So pressure, then, is N divided by volume. That's the density of our particles. There's a KT here. And if I take pressure is force per unit area, and if I take force times velocity, that's a flux. So this gives me the third component. And the way that people interpret this is that this is the pressure of the electron gas that's pushing against this little volume as it's flowing through. So it takes an additional energy to push that thing through at the average energy. Okay. I see perplexed looks on the face. Remember I told you, this is how people explain it. You know, when you get done, you know, I mean, we just made some definitions and we're very careful about what we did, and this is what we ended up. But when you always end up somewhere, you like to say, you know, how does this make sense? How could I have guessed this ahead of time? Right? If this explanation helps you, good. Right? But that's the way people think about it. Okay, now, there's still one little interesting thing that's going to happen. But here's where we are now. We have this electron continuity equation, we have this drift diffusion equation, we have this energy balance equation. This energy balance equation brought in an energy flux. And now a way that we can deal with that energy flux is we can use the energy flux in the way we've just derived it. So this relates energy flux to temperature and heat flux. Okay. I still haven't quite solved my problem because I don't know what Q is yet. Okay, if I could do something plausible for Q, then we're done. So Q is defined this way. Now, if you work that out, maybe I'll assign a homework problem. It's easy to do. If you work that out for an equilibrium Maxwellian, or even one that's displaced, as long as it has this symmetrical shape, you will find that it's always zero. You know, a lot of times, what people will do when you get down to this point, you'll say, well, a way that I can evaluate that thing that I'm missing is I can assume an equilibrium shape of F and do the integral. And of course, that's an approximation, but maybe it's okay at this point. The difficulty is, at this point, it just gives you zero. It says heat flux is zero. Occasionally, you'll find people that'll just drop it and say, I'll assume a Maxwellian distribution, and therefore Q is zero. More often, they'll say, we are accounting for a non-Maxwellian distribution to first order by assuming that heat flows down a temperature gradient. Right? That seems plausible. And as long as I can evaluate kappa, which you'll probably get from the Wiedemann-Franz law, and electron temperature, we formulated the equation in terms of electron temperature, so we're not adding any variables. But now we've got a set of equations that we can solve. Now, of course, you know, we know that heat flux doesn't just flow down a temperature gradient. There's a Peltier component, too. So you will sometimes see people do this. They'll say, well, we'll just take that heat flux. And we had this expression before that we got from Landauer or Boltzmann near equilibrium, and we'll just write it in terms here. Again, we haven't introduced any new unknowns because we have a balanced equation for J, and you know, W is related to temperature. So we have equations that we can solve. Now, there's one interesting thing. There was a question yesterday about, or last time we met, about do these equations give us the same answers as the ones that we worked out in the first part of the course? And so the relevant question here is this thing that we have defined heat flux the same as the heat flux that we had before? Right? You'd like to think that even if it's not exactly the same, it's close. Okay. And in fact, you know, when you look at most books on transport, you know, they'll just call this the heat flux and they won't relate it back to anything else. You know, but something very interesting happens. Let's say we have a bulk semiconductor uniform, no concentration gradients, and we have an electric field pointing in the minus x directions, then electrons flow in the plus x direction. Well, that means we know that the heat has to flow in the plus x direction. As long as I'm uniform and I have no gradients of temperature, the electrons will carry their Peltier heat in the plus x direction. But if you evaluate that integral for a real distribution, what you will find is that it's negative. This thing called Q, which almost every book calls it heat, is negative. It means that in this case, Q is flowing in the opposite direction that the electrons are flowing. You know, how can that be, right? The electrons are carrying their heat, right? Well, the answer is that this moment, whatever it is not heat. Right? And if you're curious about, I mean, we discover, you know, I mean, this is standard textbook stuff that's been around for 50 years. You know? But every now and then, you look at a problem and you find something new. So we discovered this. This is getting old now. But one of my students came in and showed me these calculations, said, how can this be? Heat's flowing in the wrong direction. And when we finally tracked it all down, the answer is that this thing that everybody calls heat flux when they do balance equations is not a proper definition of heat. It is some moment of the Boltzmann equation, and I don't know what physical interpretation to give it. So have a look at that paper. That's, maybe you'll remember it 25 years from now. Okay. Let's see. There was another topic that we don't have time to go into in depth, but I thought you ought to be aware of it. I wonder if we have time to say something about it. Maybe I can get halfway through. Let me pause and see if there are any questions on balance equations before we...
Has anyone ever looked at finding an electron peclite number, where we have the ratio of...
What number?
Peclite number.
All right, that's not a term I'm familiar with.
Yeah, so they use it in CFD when they make assumptions at outflow boundary conditions, but it's the ratio of the convective transport to the diffusive transport. So if you say that... Okay, our convection is what dominates transport, and you can ignore this diffusive term.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm not familiar, but with that.
It seems more physical when you just say it's zero, mm-hmm. because they have a high Peclite number, we're saying it's ignoring diffusion. So.
Yeah. That I don't know about. But these equations are used for all kinds of transport problems, right? Phonons and particles and all kinds of things, not just electrons. So a lot of what we're doing here in defining these moments and calling these things Q are done in many different ways for many different reasons. So there may be something that we can learn from some of these other literature. Yes?
So what is the conclusion of the section 2 we just looked at? I'm a little confused.
So that's a good question. Why did we go through all of this? If in the end we find that this is really fishy, I'll tell you why I did it. Because you'll read books and papers all the time where this is the way that they'll go through it. Right? I'd like you to know that it's a little fishy. Right? This whole field of balance equations, it's very difficult. You write equations, you do things that are plausible, you hope that the results are sensible. Sometimes you get in trouble. People use equations like this, they get sensible velocity profiles and carrier densities, but if you require knowing the heat flux, then you're sensitized to the fact that you shouldn't, that you're not computing heat here. I don't want you to be completely skeptical. One attitude you could get is, these balance equations aren't worth, they're too dangerous. And there is some truth to that. But, they're widely used and they're often a very good way to think about problems. When we start thinking about what happens in devices and things, we'll use this language, because it's a way to make sense out of more detailed simulations that come out. But, you know, you just, you know, the point of it is there are lots of limitations to this. And this is why 20 years ago this was a hot research topic. And everybody went in and they tried to, well, if I just terminate the hierarchy a little differently, if I just make a little different assumption here, maybe I can make all of this work. Lots of good PhD theses done. But the end result of that is you can never make it work under all conditions, right? Sometimes you can get plausible results. Sometimes you can get nonsense. And that's what makes it interesting, right? I mean, if you could just write a computer program and it gave you the right answer under all conditions. I mean, the reason you want to know something about transport is so you can know when to use what method, so you can know what to worry about, things like that. Okay, you know, enough philosophy. I'm not going to do this section. We'll see if we can start here. You should know something about heterostructures, right? If you run a standard simulation program like Centaurus or one of any standard ones, you can do things like you can feed in position-dependent composition. The effective mass can vary with position. The electron affinity can vary with position. What does the drift diffusion equation look like then? What do these balance equations look like then? So you should at least know a few things about that, or where to go if you have to know the details in a little bit more. So we'll talk about that. Then we'll dive into Monte Carlo simulation, which is a way to solve the problem exactly, right? But it has its limitations too. So sometimes you can't solve the problem that you're interested in with Monte Carlo simulation. And Monte Carlo simulation just gives you results. Sometimes you have to think about what results it's telling you. You have to think about them in terms of balance equations in order to make sense about what it's telling you.